Hey guys, welcome back to the One Shot Podcast, another episode of the One Shot Podcast. We're getting into the thick of things with the English summer coming up, and it's almost here. Coming from India, I don't think I'll ever feel that it's summer here in England, because it's never going to get as hot as India. But yeah, the summer is well and truly coming up. What that means is a lot of cricket as well, everywhere in the world. But yeah, here in England especially. And with that, today we've got a special episode talking about the domestic restructure of women's cricket here in England. A lot has been happening the past couple of months, especially now with the bidding process and so much. We'll brief you on what that is. But before that, I'd like to introduce Evie. Evie, how are you? Thanks for joining us on the One Shot Podcast. And for those of you who may remember, Evie did join us in one of the episodes in the past where we spoke about another very important topic on the transgender debate within cricket. So you can check that out as well. But yeah, without further ado, Evie, how have you been?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. I'm really, really excited to get involved with this podcast. It's really getting into the nitty gritty of this subject, and deservedly so, because we're kind of trying to address a bit of a gap. I mean, the interviews are happening as we speak on said topic. So we're trying to address that gap and make noise about it, because it deserves it, because it's just not been enough and it affects a lot of people. But yeah, basically I just write about women's cricket and other sport in general. So yeah, you can follow me on Twitter or X at EBR Ashton.
We have to be politically correct these days.
Sorry.
So, yeah, but yeah, Evie is one of our stars when it comes to cricket journalism here at the Sports Gazette. And just to brief you guys on what she was talking about with the interviews and the bidding process as well. So for those who may not know, there's a massive restructure going on within the domestic circuit of women's cricket. So we currently have the regional system, which will stay in place for the 2024 season as well. So each of the regional teams are separate entities at the moment, but they're affiliated with the various different counties. But from 2025, we're going to have a three-tier system with the tier one or the top tier comprising of 8 professional teams, which will be 8 of the first-class counties. And tiers 2 and 3 will be the amateur circuit, not professional. Now, you must be wondering how these 8 teams will be decided, who are the professional teams at the very top tier of this three-tier structure. So the ECB have launched a tender process for this. They've invited the 18 first-class counties as well as the MCC, which is something we'll get into later, why the MCC. But yeah, they've invited them to bid for these 8 professional teams. In their bids, they have to explain and, in a way, convince the ECB on why they deserve to be given one of the pro-county teams. And they have to include plans to grow women's cricket here in the UK, and also speak about the long-term investment that they want to put into the entire thing. The tiers will be closed for now, which means there will be no promotions or relegations from the lower structure, from the lower tiers into the top tier, or the other way around. And all of these 8 teams will also be receiving funding of 1.3 million each year until 2028 at least. So that's the overview of the structure. We've got 2 very special guests who we'll introduce very soon on the podcast. But Evie, quickly, your thoughts on this. First of all, have I missed anything? And just off the top of your head, what do you think about this new structure?
No, I don't think you've missed anything. You've summed it up very well. I mean, the main thing probably is that it's the third restructure in 8 years. So the Kia Super League was changed into the women's regional structure in 2020. So then we've had the past 8 teams for about 4 years, and then they've gone and done it again. And now we're going to have what I actually think is much better. Just briefly, for me, this makes much more sense, because you've got the counties can align their brand and the whole club with the men's teams. And we've seen in the 100 that works. Southern Brave have men and women as one. That works. We've seen the attendances. We've seen it just works. It just makes sense for fans as well. It's not confusing. And that is going to happen now with this restructure in 2025. The women's and the men's team, it gives more space to do clear double headers, where it's not like Southern Vipers in Hampshire, or which doesn't, like, it's not easy to understand. So yeah, we're just going to avoid that in future, which I think is much better for fans, easier to introduce new fans, and probably create a better cohesion across the men's and women's teams, potentially opening up doors to share training facilities, for them not to be so segregated, and yeah, become one united club, which I think under many principles like equity, it's just overall, I think, a better model, and yeah, opens doors for much more excitement in the women's game. What about you?
Yeah, I think I couldn't sum it up any better than you just did. But yeah, the point that you did mention, that there is no room for failure this time around, right? Because it's the third time we've seen this restructure in the last 8 years. And if we have to go down the same road again 4 years later or 3 years later, whatever it is, it's going to be an even deeper mess. So I think this model has the best chance of working based on what we've seen in the past, especially, we've seen the regional structure have a little bit of improvement, but we need to take that next step, the big step. And I think this structure will give us that. We hope it will. With every remodeling, there are certain criticisms or there are certain drawbacks as well, because no restructure is easy. And we are going to get into the heart of all of those, talk about the positives, negatives, everything, with, as I mentioned earlier, two very special guests on this podcast. So we have Raf Nicholson, women's cricket journalist and writer, and she's a historian as well, joining us on the podcast. Raf also writes for The Guardian, for whom she's done. I mean, she's basically the authority on this topic, isn't she, Evie? And we're so excited to speak to Raf today. And with Raf, we've also got Katia Whitney, who works at Wisdom Cricket, who's also, again, she's got great inputs on this and one of the stars of cricket journalism out there. So we're really excited to talk to both of them. We'd have loved to have them here with us in the studio, but they've joined us on Zoom, given that their schedules are so busy, much, much busier than any of ours. So yeah, we really appreciate them joining us on this. So first up, let's listen from Katia, who spoke to us about her thoughts on the rehaul, the new model and the structure, where the 100 fits in all of this, which is a very important point. And we also got her thoughts on players who would probably have to relocate because of this new structure, how they would be looked after, a little bit about the fan cultures as well with these county teams, and more.
So yeah, for the first question, feel free to go wherever you want with this one. But as a women's cricket writer, or just general cricket writer, was the rehaul the right thing to do?
I think that there'll be a lot of different opinions on whether the rehaul was the right thing to do, because it's the third restructure in 8 years. I think what they've risked by doing it is that lack of continuity. So what we've seen with the regional sides is they've actually been able to build up their own brands, to where they're now very recognisable entities in cricket, not just in women's cricket. Southern Vipers, Northern Diamonds is very much part of the domestic cricket vernacular now. And having only established that 4 years ago, they do run the risk of the growth not being allowed to build on that. But if you look at what the regional structure allows for, I think it's quite clear that given the scale of change and advancement that's needed, it's going to very quickly outgrow that regional system if it's not changed in some way. So speaking to some of the counties ahead of the presentations they're doing to the ECB this week, what's been very clear is that the sense of identity that they have as cricket teams is not quite there in the regional structure at the minute. So if you're a Hampshire fan, there's a disconnect between the Hampshire fans and the Southern Vipers. They don't see it particularly as a Hampshire side, even though it's based at Southampton, because it's made up of, like, George Adams, their captain, came through the Sussex Academy, and it covers such a massive area of the South. And across the season, they have to go around grounds and tick box different grounds that they've played at, so they're not always playing at Southampton. I think particularly as well for Northern Diamonds, it's an issue because Yorkshire has such an identity-based fan base, that they really struggle to bring the crowds in for Northern Diamonds games because members don't see them as a Yorkshire cricket club. And also, if we look at the scale of the area that Northern Diamonds cover, they cover all the way up to Northumberland and all the way down to Chesterfield. So that's been an issue with it. If we look at Western Storm, they cover the whole of Wales, Cornwall, Devon, Somerset, Wiltshire, everywhere. So you're going to struggle to pull in a dedicated fan base unless you have a solid identity that's already established to do that. So in that sense, I think it's the right thing to do. I think there are definite warning signs with what they're doing that means then they're going to have to work pretty hard to make sure this system is a success, because what we don't want to happen is to change the whole thing, go through this restructure, put all this money into it, and then have to change it again in 4 years' time, because that's really not going to go down well, most of all with the players, because the players have adapted to this regional system, which has been a success. The aim of the regional system was to condense the talent down at the top of the regional level and have higher quality women's domestic cricket, which then feeds into a stronger England side. And they've adapted to that, and it's undoubtedly done that. If you then tell the players again in 4 years' time, actually, got it wrong again, we're going to have to change again, I don't think they're going to be massively happy with it. And I think they'll get slated for that. So I think the emphasis should be whether this is the right choice or not. This is what's been committed to. Now we really need to make this work and put all the energy into making this work at a structural level so that it's not needed to change again.
Right. And just, you know, just on the first looks of it and just everything that we know about this new proposed structure that's going to be in place, it just definitely looks, and Evie and I were talking about it earlier as well, it just looks a lot better than what we've had before, even though, like you mentioned, and we all know that it's like the third restructure in the last 8 years, right? But at the same time, because it is the third restructure in the last 8 years, this one really has to go right. Because if we're going to be changing it after 4 years, it's just a much bigger mess. So do you have any big worries with this proposed remodel or some criticisms of it given, and which you think should be fixed like pretty soon or should be focused on, because again, saying that it can't really go wrong this time?
I think my main concern is around the counties that don't get their tier one sides. So what's happening at the minute is that the ECB is open to tender for first-class counties to bid for the tier one sides, which will effectively be the 8 regional sides, but with control handed back to the counties. And 16 of the 18 first-class counties have put bids in for that. So there's going to be 8 of them who aren't going to get these tier one sides. And what the ECB is doing is they're putting £1.3 million of investment for each team per year until 2028. So that's a massive funding gap between sides that have tier one sides and sides that have tier two sides and tier three sides, which will be semi-professional and unprofessional until at least 2028, I think. So what happens to women's cricket in those counties, I think, is going to be particularly difficult and also something that the ECB are going to have to think about quite a lot. Because what we want to do now is we want to expand the amount of professional cricketers, women's cricketers there are in the country, and we want to build up the competition so there can be more than 8 sides that are competitive and that there's more paths for women to become professional domestic cricketers if they want to. Because, you know, what we've got to remember is England shouldn't be seen as the be-all and end-all. You should be able to make a very good living from being a professional cricketer, even if you're not playing for England. And at the minute, there's very few people who can do that. So that's something that they're going to need to think about. If we think about who doesn't have a regional side at the minute, Glamorgan doesn't have a regional side based at where it is. It's based in Taunton. So if Glamorgan doesn't get a regional side, what happens to Welsh women's cricketers? Do they have to then move to England and move to Taunton or wherever gets the tier one side nearest them to play professional cricket? So that's a consideration that needs to happen. I think there's also consideration about where the matches are played for the Charlotte Edwards Cup and the Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy. The calendar is a mess as it is, and it's ever expanding across the domestic summer with the 100 and with County Championship, T20 Blast, Royal London. Am I missing anything? You know, there's so much and it's always the woman who seem to miss out when there's too much cricket played on a 22-yard strip. And there's only so much cricket that can be played on a 22-yard strip. And I know some of the plans for the tier one sides involve a lot of playing at outgrounds, but it kind of doesn't sit right that that's where the women are being made to play when pretty much all the men's matches will be at the county grounds, unless there's a massive clash in schedule. And when we think about when the Charlotte Edwards Cup is over by June. There is no reason they shouldn't be playing at the big grounds, the test match grounds. at that time? And if we want to draw more crowds in, where are you more likely to go? Are you going to go to Southampton where the transport links are good? Are you going to try and get to Arundel or Wormsley where the transport links aren't good? So that's something they also need to think about and establish a priority of who gets that. And maybe do a bit of shuffling around in the calendar so that there's more dedicated time for women's cricket in the calendar as well.
Thank you for going into such depth and explaining all of that. And it kind of fits into the next question, which was going to be, you mentioned, where does the 100 fit in all of this? You've obviously alluded to it, but yeah, could you expand a bit more on that and the calendar and what the 100's role is now?
So the 100 is obviously ring-fenced in August, where the only cricket that really goes along, the only domestic cricket that really goes alongside that is the Royal London Cup for the men, which is now used as kind of a development tournament for a lot of counties, because the best players go off and play the 100. Quite rightly so, there's a lot of money to be earned in the 100, and you can't ask people to turn down that amount of money. Similarly with the women, although women's 100 salaries are a fraction of what the men's 100 salaries are, there's still a lot of money to be made for 4 weeks work in the 100. And you can't ask players to go off and not play that at the expense of domestic cricket. So there's not much domestic cricket that goes on alongside the 100. But I think what we've seen with the 100 at the minute is that there are huge crowds coming in to see the 100, and the women are an integral part of the 100. It's not just that there's two competitions or one competition. If you didn't have the women playing the 100 wouldn't be as successful as it is. So when the Commonwealth Games was on year before last and the 100 started with only the men, there was a noticeable drop in the crowd sizes for the 100 because the women weren't playing and because you weren't getting these double headers. However, that hasn't necessarily translated into the Charlotte Edwards Cup and the Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy. I think a lot of it is based on what I mentioned earlier, which is the identity side of things. People can identify with a strong brand that they feel connected to. And if you've got a men's and women's team under the same branding with a concerted, very good marketing effort, then crowds will come in, as we've seen with the 100. But the Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy in particular doesn't really have that. I think the final for the Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy was played at Northants on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon in September last year, while there was an international series going on alongside it. So players weren't available. So there's a lot of disparity in terms of the marketing and the priority given to the 100 compared to the women's domestic format. And that kind of seeps into the difference between the two. But hopefully what this domestic structure can do is allow for counties to do more things like double headers with the T20 Blast and to market their women's sides more effectively. I think the prime example is actually, I know I've talked about them before, but the Southern Vipers. So obviously the Southern Vipers last year won both the Charlotte Edwards Cup and the Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy, and then the Southern Brave won the 100 Trophy. And with all of them based at Southampton, there is a concerted effort to put those sides in together as almost one entity, albeit under slightly different names. And if that can happen with the county sides as well, when they're eventually turned over to tier one status, I think that will make the change more of a success. I think what a lot of counties or what a lot of people tend to do is they work against the 100 rather than work with it. If you use the 100 to build off the back and feed into domestic cricket, then that's what's going to be a success. The issue will come when sides who don't have a 100 side and don't have a tier one side, or who do have a tier one side and don't have a 100 side, don't have that branding opportunity available to them. I mentioned Glamorgan earlier. Glamorgan have a 100 side, but they don't have a women's side or a tier one, or a regional side based at Sapphire Gardens. So that's going to be interesting to see how it's navigated.
Yeah. And, you know, the entire, I mean, what they've been saying, especially the ECB, the people at the top, is they've been using this term evolving together, right? Where they're saying that this isn't just a plan for, we don't want to, you know, develop or grow women's cricket as a standalone, but in a coordination or alongside the men's structures that are already in place with most of these counties. And they're also hoping that kind of the fan following that many of these men's teams have, I mean, they can even feed off of that for the women's teams and that structure as well. So do you think that that is kind of a good plan, the right way to go? Or is there, because I don't know, maybe this is me thinking out loud, but I was thinking about how the fandom or the fan following will be affected. For example, if right now there's a regional system within women's cricket here in the UK, right? But, you know, now there's just possibility that the one of the counties within the region will get one of the tier one teams. Will that kind of, because counties within a region, I mean, neighboring counties also have this sense of rivalry, will the other counties that do not have that one of those eight teams, will they even still feel that sense of support or that sense of connection to that one county? Or do you think it takes away from it a little bit?
I think it's going to be difficult because, like I said, the tier two sides and the tier three sides are not going to be professional sides, at least for the next 5 years. So when you look at the standard gap between when you pay people to play cricket and when you don't pay people to play cricket, it is understandably huge. So it's going to be difficult to foster that sense of following and belonging when you don't have a professional women's side. It's more than anything because you can't afford to do a lot of the things that you would need to do to build a following. You can't afford to have specific branded stuff and advertised campaigns and whatever else you need to do to build that team up. And quite frankly, there's not an organised domestic tournament for tier two sides and tier three sides to play in at the minute. You've got the Women's County Championship, which is a T20 competition, which it happens in April most years. And from going to some of the matches a couple of years ago, a lot of them are played at school grounds or club grounds. I think I went to one that was just off the M62, which was a weird one. So there's not that kind of ability to play a high enough standard of cricket in the right places that will attract a following. I hope that there's no detail on this, but I hope part of the 5-year plan is to eventually get those tier two sides at least into professional status. And I also know that the end goal of this tier one, tier two, tier three is for there to be promotion and relegation. If that is the end goal, then that kind of alludes to the fact that you want to raise the standards of the counties below the 8 regional sides and the 8 tier one sides. So we'll have to wait and see how that happens. But like I said, it's going to take a long, long time to fast track the women's domestic format to what they want it to be and what it should be and what it kind of should have been much earlier than this. You know, if you look at Australia, I know there's lots of different factors that go into why they were able to do that. But the women's domestic circuit in Australia has incredible investment and is of an incredibly high standard. And the depth of player pool that they're able to draw from because of that is enormous. So it's in everyone's benefit to raise these tier two sides up to the standard and make them professional and give them access to facilities and standards and have a huge following behind them. But it's going to take a lot of time, unfortunately.
Yeah, and as part of the kind of support, well, I'm not sure it was really outlined in the document, but as you mentioned earlier, there's going to be consequences in terms of players having to relocate because they can't compete with the new professional, like players who've been training once a week are going to be shoved alongside players who are now professional. So players might have to move, or even professional players might have to move counties and, you know, move from a whole lifestyle to a new lifestyle, which is costly, like mentally, financially, etc. So, yeah, I was wondering if you could expand a bit more on like the impact that the players will feel personally and how you think that they should be looked after.
I think what's a really under-mentioned part of that is the support group that you have in the place where you either grew up or the place that you live in as a young adult, which most of these players are. And if you have to move away from that support group, that does have effects, whether it's on mental health or your ability to just function as part of your life. If you have kids, if you're a mother, if you're a mother, or if you have family caring responsibilities, that is a lot to draw you away from that. But that is what players have been asked to do when this regional structure happened and might be asked to do again if the hub is in a different place to where they are currently based. And the effect is huge. I kind of have a double opinion on it, where that a lot of people are expected to move for jobs and that's a choice that you make. But the reason they're being asked to move is because the ECB didn't get it right the first time and they didn't get it right the second time. And now they're trying again. So it's like I said at the beginning, players want them to get it right this time so they don't have to do that all over again. And I think that's a very reasonable request to make, that you're not uprooting your life or changing the whole way that you operate in your job every 4 years, because that is not sustainable. But I think that, I generally think that these eight tier one sides will be very similar to the regional sides that we know at the minute. I find it very hard to imagine that Headingley won't have a side, that Southampton won't have a side, that Old Trafford won't have a side, that Warwickshire won't have a side, that the Oval and that Lords won't have a side. So those are six that already, that it's hard to imagine. So it won't be too many players, I think, that are asked to relocate. I think what's also troubling for the players is travelling within the season to get to all these different grounds. Just because I spoke to a couple of them the other day, I know that the Vipers have to go around Southampton, Wormsley, Arundel, and up to a couple of different outgrounds as well throughout the season. And that, I think, really annoys them because it means that they're on the road all the time and in hotels and having to do all this stuff, plus having away fixtures up north and out everywhere else. So if you can get people a base and you can allow them to stay in that base, that's going to be one of the most effective outcomes of this change on how the players are allowed to be professional in their careers.
So that was Katia Whitney from Wisden. Let's now hear what Raf Nicholson had to say about all of this as well. Raf spoke to us about her thoughts on this entire model and the new structure, whether it was always part of the ECB's plan for women's cricket, or is it just in response to the ICEC report? Where does all of this fit within the overall plans for equality and equity within cricket? How Lancashire has shown to be a great example for something like this, and why invite the MCC in the first place to bid for the process? Let's hear what Raf had to say.
So obviously this marks the third major upheaval of like the women's domestic restructure in 8 years. And, you know, as an expert, this is a really broad question, but just to start us off, was this the right thing to do?
I think it is the right thing to do, but I think it's a shame that it's taken us this many iterations and kind of big upheavals in order to get here. Because obviously we haven't had the current system, whereby we have 8 regions, which are kind of amalgamations of different counties, has only been in place since 2020. And before that, we had the Kia Super League, which was kind of abolished because of bringing in the hundreds. Before that, we had the Women's County Championship. And so we're now almost going back 2 iterations to what we had before, which is a system whereby women's county cricket is dominant. And I think that what happens when you make big changes and you kind of cause upheaval is that you don't bring people along on that journey with you. And so there will be people who the ECB have kind of lost along the way, because 4 years ago they were told, well, women's county cricket doesn't really matter. And now they're being told, actually, it does. And we're recentering our whole domestic structure around it. And that's got to be quite frustrating for some people. So I think it is the right thing, but it's a shame that it's taken this long to get here.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And would you say that, as on the same kind of tangent, was this always part of the ECB's plan? Or do you think it was in more of a response, like as in like when they did the first, like after the Kia to like the 8-team thing, like was this the long-term plan? Or, because I know in your article you mentioned about it could be a potential response to the ICEC report. What do you think, was this always part of the plan? Like, was this the vision?
It definitely wasn't always part of the plan. Because as I say, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I was sat in meetings at the ECB offices, or kind of press briefings at the ECB offices, being told that women's county cricket wasn't part of that long-term vision and didn't really matter. And there actually was an attempt by the ECB to completely abolish women's county cricket. They had to then kind of reverse ferret on that a little bit because they realised that it was unfeasible and that there were a lot of people who they'd kind of annoyed quite a lot by this suggestion that they were just going to ditch it completely. But that was their initial plan, I believe, was just to completely move away from all county structures and focus on this idea of regions whereby counties would work together. I think that there are a couple of things that have changed the ECB's perspective on this. And one of them is the ICEC report. The ICEC kind of has slightly fed into this for a couple of reasons. I think that there is an element of there being a criticism of the fact that the regions are not represented within the ECB's kind of decision-making structures. And the easiest way to fix that is actually to go, okay, well, we'll give the women's teams representation via the existing counties. Otherwise, what you've got to do is somehow bring on the 8 regions as separate kind of entities into your decision-making structures. And that's quite complex. And you then have to get buy-in from the kind of existing men's counties anyway. So I think the ICEC has played a little bit of a role in that respect. The other thing that's been really big and has really impacted in this is the success of the 100, which obviously, again, didn't start until 2021. So when we just in kind of the second year of the regional structure, and has been quite instrumental on the ECB's thinking, partly because the restructure is being led by the same woman who was so influential in the Women's 100, Beth Barrett Wild. So she's been kind of very, it's sort of, I think it's been her vision in both cases that's been very important. But what the 100 has shown is that if you bring the women's and the men's kind of brands and teams together and you have them aligned, that you can get a real buy-in from the audience, and that actually you'll get many more people turning up to watch women's cricket because it's the same brand and they feel that they can buy into it. Whereas actually the problem that we've had with women's regional cricket is that, you know, it's still, you've got maybe 100 or 200 people turning up to matches maximum. And so that's not a great kind of long-term vision for where we want women's domestic cricket to be. And I guess the ECB are kind of saying the reason for that is that actually the current kind of fan base or follower base of English cricket is very driven by counties and county identities. So if I'm a Surrey supporter, I don't know why I would bother to go and watch the South East Stars, for example, because they aren't Surrey. And, you know, the ECB was very deliberate in that. They said, we don't want it to be the Surrey Stars. We want it to be the South East Stars because we want Kent to have some ownership over it as well. But what that's meant is that it's kind of fallen between two stools. And so you haven't made Kent fans happy. You haven't made Surrey fans happy. And then that's reflected kind of nationally at all of these regions, really. So I think that the success of the 100 has really kind of shaped the thinking on this to go, well, it will be better and it'll be, it's an easier way to grow women's cricket if you have the men's and the women's team brands aligned.
Right. And Raf, you know, when they invited the teams, the counties to bid for this entire process, there were four main points on which they wanted clarity, or I should say they wanted the bidders to convince them on how they can kind of promote the women's game. One was the larger vision that they have for doing this, quality of cricket, the fan base, kind of, you know, having a more passionate fan base, and the long-term value, monetary value, commercial value that this would generate. Do you think that the model could have gone further and put even stricter criteria on them? Because in one of the pieces that you did write for The Guardian recently, you did mention, right, that numerous counties in their bids, you know, did say things like the women's team will probably have to play on a club ground or a school ground because the main ground is going to be occupied by the men's team. Again, there is that mindset or the mentality over there that, okay, the women will have to make the sacrifice, even though this entire process, I mean, that is completely against the base spirit of this entire process. So do you think they could have gone, of course, the interviews will take care of some of those things, but do you think there could have been even stricter criteria than what the 4 points?
I think that those four criteria come from the document that the ECB have kind of shared publicly. But actually, behind the scenes, my understanding is that they have been, they have kind of asked some much sort of more stringent questions of the counties who want to bid for teams. And so actually, it hasn't been, it's actually been I think the counties have had to show quite a lot of commitment when they've submitted their bids. One of the things that I've seen that hasn't been released publicly is actually the kind of full list of questions that the counties had to answer when they wrote their bids. And I think there are something like 32 questions, and they're all really amazing questions. And I've got to say, I think that Beth Barrett Wild has got her hands all over this because she's really like a huge force for equity. You know, there it's questions like, how are you going to make the women's team feel welcome from day one? And how are the women going to have a voice within the wider decision making structures in the club? How many kind of women and you know, people from different minority groups are you going to have in your kind of women's side of things? Like how is that going to work? So there is that kind of broader equity piece that they're trying to bring in. And, you know, what's your coaching structure going to look like? How are you going to market the women, to the maximum capabilities? Where do the women sit within the priority of your organization, which is always a big one that really bugs me, because it feels like that women's cricket is like at the bottom of the priority list. So in order to bid for one of these teams, you're really having to make quite a compelling case that you're going to put women's cricket first. And so I think that there's been a bit more of a stringent process going on, but it's just that that document that the ECB released maybe didn't give all of the details.
And please feel free to give us some more details on the interview process on the podcast today, because as we're speaking, the interviews are going on. They started yesterday, they're today, and I believe the third round is Monday. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, it's very exciting. It's all very current. I think it's going to be quite a taxing process, actually, that they've got to the counties who have bid. So we know that 16 counties have bid for 8 teams. So 50% of them are going to be disappointed. I think it's great that that information's got into the public domain, because what that means is that the counties have really then got to up their game when they go and present their bids to the ECB. So it's quite exciting, really. They've got to go and do these presentations at the ECB offices at Lord's in London. And then there's going to be like 45 minutes of questioning. They've obviously got some kind of external people sort of coming in to help judge the bids, which is quite unusual for cricket to allow that to happen. So I think that's really exciting. So they've got Maggie Murphy from Lewis FC, which obviously a football club kind of whose brand is basically all about equity of the men and the women. And Kelly Simmons, who's kind of former head of women's football at the FA. So really, really exciting people who are going to be judging these bids and doing it in a way that is not going to make it easy for the counties. And I think that's going to make it a much more kind of stringent process, and that we're going to get a better outcome as a result, because it's going to be harder for counties to kind of just pull the wool over the ECB's eyes and go, oh yeah, of course, and just kind of pay lip service to it, which was one of my big concerns, actually, kind of reading about how the whole process was going to work, that counties would be able to do that. But I think that there's quite a lot of safeguards being put in place to ensure that that doesn't happen.
Yeah, you just mentioned that it was, one of your concerns that you had with this entire process. But if I just had to ask you, from the top, if you just look at it, you mentioned at the start as well that we would have loved if this kind of model would have come earlier. So it's definitely a positive step, one in the right direction, the intention of this all. But if I had to ask you, if you had two big criticisms or worries about the entire model, first of all, do you have any, and which would those be?
Yeah, well, as I've just said, I think that it does concern me that that there's going to be potential for kind of lip service to be paid by the counties. I guess the other thing is that with the counties kind of taking over the women's teams, what we've got at the moment is sort of independent women's entities, these regions that are staffed by people who really care about women's cricket and know a lot about it. We've got a lot of knowledge now of people who've kind of really been tasked with putting in place this new professional structure that's now kind of 4 years old. With the counties taking it over, it does concern me a bit that we might kind of accidentally leak some of that knowledge, that the counties will have their own people, their own agenda, their own staff that they want to put on working on these women's teams, and that, therefore we might lose some really good people. So what I hope is that the existing regional staff will be redeployed within counties, but there's no guarantee that that will happen. That's kind of up to the counties. So I guess that's one of my concerns. The other one was something that you mentioned earlier in the podcast about grounds. And, there are kind of, like rumours and information sort of circling a little bit kind of off the record that some of these bids have been very much shaped around the women not playing very much at the main ground, and that therefore they will feel... Well, therefore, it will feel that we've gone very much backwards, because what we've got at the moment with the regional teams is that the women are able to play at multiple different first class grounds because the counties share them. So if we're Southern Vipers, I can play at the Aegeus Bowl or I can play at Hove, because the Vipers are shared by Hampshire and Sussex. Well, if the Vipers go to Hampshire, let's say, they can then only play at the Aegeus, which is already kind of overstretched as far as the facility goes. And Sussex probably aren't going to welcome the Vipers turning up if Sussex lose a bid and going, can we please play on your ground? So that's something that you lose. And if counties from the start are saying, oh, well, we're just going to push our women out to an outground or a club ground or a school ground, nice as they may be, they don't have the spectator facilities or the media facilities that we need in order to move domestic women's cricket into a new kind of more commercially successful era. So a school ground is fine if you've got, like, I don't know, 80 or 100 people turning up. But if you really want to get 5,000 people regularly going to women's cricket, that's just not going to cut it. And I don't think that anyone's come up with any solution yet, other than, I guess, counties building new grounds, which some of them are potentially doing. But then are they just going to then push the women out to the new ground? And then they don't necessarily then feel like they really belong. And belonging is really important in this, because for this to work, the counties really have to kind of bring the women on board within their club and make them feel like they are, you know, like they are at home. And that, you know, for example, if Surrey win, that the Oval is the women's home as well as the men's home. And if the women are playing all their matches somewhere else, that's not going to work. So that concerns me as well.
Yeah, and in terms of equity, as you just mentioned, with that difference, moving across to the long-term goal of like equal pay and stuff, obviously the press release says, quote, changes aim to grow the demand and audience for women's cricket that will create the long-term commercial conditions that can lead to pay parity. So I just wondered, like, what does that actually mean? And does it kind of reinforce the assumption that equity is sort of tied to like private interests and the market forces, which we know has never brought justice to like any minority? Does it reinforce that sort of assumption that like women only deserve equality if they've got like the views or the people turning up? And maybe is that fair? I'm not sure, but yeah, I'm just wondering what that kind of pay parity statement means and whether it's realistic or fair or just thoughts were on it.
I mean, it's partly that's the ECB's overall response to the ICEC's criticism of the huge pay disparity that currently exists within English cricket. That the ECB have said, well, you've recommended that we implement equal pay very quickly, as in within the next like 2 or 3 years across all levels of the game, international and domestic. And we don't think that's realistic because the market doesn't allow for it. And women's cricket isn't in a kind of place commercially where we can currently pay women the same as the men. So, yes, it is that. I think that's what it's referring to. And it is a massive cop out. And, you know, the other thing to some extent is if you push the women out to be run by the counties, then when equal pay isn't introduced, the ECB can say, well, that's in the hands of the counties now. So if you're being cynical about it, then there is an element of the ECB can kind of slightly pass out that responsibility for introducing equal pay at domestic level. But I tend to agree with you, Evie, that I think that these arguments about kind of equal pay relies on commercial growth are a bit reductive. I think we're never going to see full professionalism within women's sport, specifically women's cricket, if you rely on the market, because you need that professional investment for the players to be able to devote their livelihood to playing cricket, then the product gets better and then people will go and see it. If you wait for that to happen, then we just won't get change. And it'll take several generations as well. So I do find that argument a bit of a cop-out. I mean, the other really clear thing in men's cricket is that they play the Red Bull competition, the Men's County Championship, and it's clearly a loss leader. Like, it clearly doesn't make money. It's incredibly expensive to run. But nobody ever says, oh, well, perhaps we should take the money that's being used to run the Men's County Championship and redistribute that amongst cricket, or maybe we should pay Red Bull men's players a bit less, actually, because it's not really worth it. But that's essentially the argument that they make for women's cricket. So it's a massive double standard as much as anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. I really agree with you in every way. And on a separate note, I was thinking about the Lancashire model, and obviously you wrote about how you had an interview with some of the players and they were talking about how great that model is in terms of, because you mentioned earlier about having like the men's and the women's team under like one brand and one club. I was kind of thinking like, well, Lancashire have been doing this for a while. Why haven't the other counties like seen this and thought, oh, we should do that? Like the other regional teams, I mean. And kind of, do you think there'll be, with this restructure, do you think people will want to copy the Lancashire model? Like, or is there a hesitancy to do that?
I mean, it's difficult to know what goes on in the minds of some of the people who run county cricket, I must say. I think that some of it comes down to the people who run county cricket at the moment. They were kind of very famously described in the ICEC report as type Ks. So, and by that, the ICEC meant kind of white middle-class men of a certain age who do tend to predominate massively. Not so much at the ECB anymore, although a little bit, but within the county structures, it's run by type Ks. And so the whole way in which they see cricket and the kind of lens through which they see cricket is, well, men's cricket and largely kind of men's Red Bull cricket is this amazing thing that we need to nurture and care for and look after. And that's our priority. And, oh, yeah, it's nice to kind of pat the women on the head every so often and maybe give them a little bit of a leg up. But the idea that women's cricket might deserve kind of equal treatment and total parity and kind of being marketed on the same level, and that the women should also go on the same kind of pre-season tours as the men, all of the things that Lancashire are doing, I genuinely think just doesn't enter the heads of some of these people. They've just got a totally different way of kind of looking at cricket and looking at the world to the one that you or I have. So I was thinking about this kind of question, and I don't really know what the answer is. It would be really interesting to know what they would say. But yeah, I just think it's just a kind of fundamentally different way of looking at cricket, I suppose.
Even though the 100 has shown it works, but
Yes, but these are people who hate the 100, yeah. Right? Even though a lot of them are kind of running counties and are happy to take the ECB's £1 million kind of compensation. They and a lot of their members really dislike the 100. Whether they're a county who hosts a 100 team or not, there is an awful lot of dislike about the 100. And it doesn't matter that it's done really great things for women's cricket. In fact, if we're being really cynical, that's almost like a negative point potentially for some of these people, because women's cricket is becoming harder and harder to ignore. In the way that they've quite comfortably done for many generations.
And, you know, you did mention earlier that they have, they've included the likes of Kelly Simmons and Maggie Murphy in this entire process, which is, you know, it's really interesting and it's really nice, because we've seen, you know, women's football also follows a similar structure. And so it's good to have, you know, those voices as well, people who have kind of had a contribution to kind of making women's football at least better than what it was earlier. So what do you think cricket can learn from the kind of a similar structure in women's football? Because, you did speak about just a while back about the practice or the worry of funds earmarked for women's cricket being redirected into the men's game. That happened in football, where we saw, the Karen Carney review last year said that was actually a widespread practice in football. So what do you think cricket can learn from football with this entire remodeling?
Well, I think that the whole kind of conception of the remodel is being partly driven by the success that we've seen in the Women's Super League, with the teams all being kind of aligned together. I actually feel kind of conflicted about this and like a little bit sad that a team in women's football like the Doncaster Bells, for example, as an independent women's club, haven't been able to succeed under the current model, because the strategy from the FA has very much been, we expect women's teams to join up with men's clubs and be aligned, and that's the way to kind of get women's football to grow. But unfortunately, it's difficult to argue with the results, like 60,000 people crowding into the Emirates regularly now to watch the Arsenal women's team. And Arsenal are the ones who have kind of very historically had this aligned model for longer than anybody else in women's football. So I think that the ECB are looking at the success of the Women's Super League and going, yeah, that's where we want women's cricket to go. I do think that there are kind of lessons that we can learn, or that cricket can learn, from women's football, in the sense of, I do think that often in women's sport, what we see is a lot of concentration of finance and resources at the top level and not putting those kind of sustainable structures in place underneath. And I think that, I'm actually running an event looking at equity in kind of women's grassroots football in a couple of weeks' time. And I think that there are a lot of people working within those structures underneath the top levels of the WSL and the Championship who feel that the FA have slightly neglected them. And at that level, it can be harder as a women's club to have an effective voice and to make a case for yourself, and also to kind of, you know, some of them are struggling financially. And I think that we've seen that in cricket as well, that actually a lot of the ECB's focus has been on very much at the elite level, and that what we really need now is actually more of a focus on putting those sustainable structures in place underneath. So we need more women's clubs. We need it not to be a kind of postcode lottery whereby I might have to travel 50 miles in order to play a decent level of hardball club cricket as a woman. So I think that there are great things we can learn from women's football, but it's not a total panacea. And I also think other women's sports are looking at what women's cricket has done and are excited by it as well. So, apparently Beth Barrett Wild has been having some good conversations with women's rugby, for example. How can women's rugby kind of emulate the success of the 100? So I think that's really interesting in terms of women's sport, in this sort of sense of, and the bringing in Kelly Simmons and Maggie Murphy into this process is a particularly good example of it, of actually kind of everyone working together to try to achieve this sort of equity and this kind of generational step forward in the growth of women's sport. So that's very interesting, and I quite like it.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's another thing that, you know, Evie and I were discussing about as well, is they've invited, of course, the 18 first-class counties along with the MCC to bid for this process. The question is, and their entire aim is, of course, evolving together, to use the term that they've been using, having the men's and women's team under the same brand, growing together. That then why invite the MCC? Because they do not have a professional men's team, right? So what's exactly the idea of having the MCC also bid for this entire process? Because if, you know, we spoke about the aims, and if the MCC doesn't fall in that, then it's pretty unlikely that they'll be successful in, with one of the bids. So then why invite them in the first place?
Yeah, it's a bit baffling, to be honest. I was slightly confused by it. I don't know. I mean, I suppose you could argue that the MCC is a very influential organisation within domestic English cricket and indeed international cricket and global cricket, and therefore that they wanted to try to kind of leverage some of that influence potentially. What's obviously ended up happening is that, despite the fact that the ECB explicitly said that we don't accept partnerships in this process, so they don't want counties to kind of bid together, Middlesex released something saying we're bidding and MCC are our partner. And they actually used the word partner. But then I think I tweeted about this saying, but that's not allowed. And Middlesex were like, oh, no, they're not like a partner. They're just a partner. So I don't really know what's going on there. I don't really know why that's kind of allowed, given that it was kind of explicitly something the ECB said they didn't want. So, yeah, you'd need to ask Beth Barrett Wild that one, to be honest. I'm afraid I don't have all the answers.
We'd love to.
I think it says a lot that, like you're the leading women's cricket journalist and it's still unclear to you. Like, it's, that says something in of itself. So just like you giving that answer, I think it speaks volumes. And very briefly, could you just, because I realise that we're running out of time, or have run out of time, could you just briefly summarise, with all of this context in mind, what do you think is the ECB's purpose with this restructure? Like, just to sum it up, like, is it equity? Like, just, is there a sum up kind of sentence or two?
I think the kind of short to medium term purpose is to grow women's domestic cricket so that it becomes kind of self-sustainable financially, so that the ECB aren't having to aren't having to fund it themselves. And that's going to require a lot of growth. So I think that this whole thing has come about because the regional structure has, while it's put in place really good pathways and it's generated a whole kind of new generation of professional women's cricketers, it hasn't done anything to grow the sort of market or the audience for women's cricket. And so that's where they're really looking now. They're trying to develop the fan base, and therefore, you know, potentially be able to kind of leverage getting women's cricket or women's domestic cricket as part of the next broadcast deal, which will be in 2028 or 2029. So that's what I think they're going for. And I do think equity is part of it, but I think the ECB would say that kind of that genuine equity and equality is still quite a long way off, and that's maybe like the long term goal, and this is the first step on that journey. But the most important thing is to try to get it so that women's cricket or women's domestic cricket is making a bit more money for itself, or making some money for itself. And then you can go, okay, then the argument for things like equal pay becomes much harder to ignore. So that's what I think their purpose is.
Wow, Evie, that was so great, wasn't it? Talking to both Raf and Katya about something that, as we said at the very start, has not had that much coverage, and we intend to, you know, get more coverage out there about this. So, yeah, I mean, I've learned so much from just these past few minutes that we've spoken to both Raf and Katya. What are your biggest takeaways?
Yeah, I think my biggest takeaway is, well, firstly, that there are so many different questions that you can ask about this. And I think we have to continue to be critical of like every step that they take, because we don't want the ECB ever getting complacent over what they've promised, or... You know, we want to make sure that the process benefits everyone and not, you know, just the tier one clubs as well. So it's just about being critical of every level and, you know, making sure that every voice is included. And with that said, I think player voices, the fact that they've been more part of the process, in Raf Nicholson's article, they mentioned that they felt that they were like way more included, and like they were part of the discussion over this restructure, and they want to hear from the players like how this is going to affect them and what they think. They are ultimately like this is their lives. So yeah, I think it's great that they've had those voices, and it's important that that continues. It's a democracy in a way. It's good to have all those voices, all those votes. As I said, I've got more questions than I do answers. It's just, this conversation has, triggered more questions, but they've given such important input and given things that we just would never have thought about, and things that just the general public won't be aware of, and hopefully will make the process even better as a result.
Yeah, I mean, with something like this, it's always so important to ask so many questions, right? Because there's always going to be something that, you know, the brief that's given by the ECB or whoever, and just in general in women's sport or in any sport, when there is such a restructuring happening, something so big happening, there's always going to be a lot of information thrown at you, but you're going to have to ask a lot of questions, because some of the questions that we ask could also lead to people higher up who they've probably not thought about it. The questions we ask could kind of urge them to think about that. And that's pretty much our role as journalists. So yeah, it was, like you said, so good talking to these two experts on the matter. And yeah, I couldn't agree more that there are more questions, but that's a good thing. That's a step in the right direction. Well, if the model turns out to be a step in the right direction or not, we'll see. It does seem so right now, but we'll keep our eye on it. As we're speaking, just to summarize, the interviews are happening. So the teams, the counties have submitted their bids. The interview started yesterday, that is March 21st. Today and Monday, March 25th, I think, are the two remaining rounds of interviews. And yeah, pretty soon, I think next month or so, we should know which of the eight counties have been successful in with their bids and in securing the eight professional teams at the very top of the structure. Guys, thank you so much for joining us on the One Shot podcast. We're gonna come back soon on this topic with another episode. As I said, once we have more information on the teams or the counties that have won, we will have Evie and myself hopefully have a guest, but Evie and myself, we'll definitely speak more on this topic as well. And as you guys already know, a lot of other things on the One Shot podcast going forward. So stay tuned, take care until then, and we'll see you very soon.
Bye.